Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, more than 3 months after the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, the survivors who became gun control activists may be deciding how their generation will be remembered. Carolyn Davis is with the Public Religion Research Institute, a nonprofit organization that studies religion, culture, and public policy. She spoke with VOA about the history of student activism in the United States. She said, "It's the beginning of something really, really compelling, a new generation of political movement." She added, "You look at the civil rights movement, you look at the anti-war movement. These are movements led by students, led by young people, so there's precedence for this. Suffrage and the American Revolution, in large part, were fought by people about this age." 17 people died in the February 14th shooting at Parkland's Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. David Hogg has become one of the most well-known of Parkland's student activists. He recently announced a boycott of Publix food stores. He made the announcement after learning the company had donated money to a man hoping to become Florida's next governor. The candidate, a member of the Republican Party, is a supporter of the National Rifle Association, a gun rights group. Hogg and other student activists organized a die-in protest. Students lay on the floor of several Publix stores in the state to create the appearance of students killed by gun violence. On May 25th, Publix announced it was halting all political donations. Hogg told VOA in March, "This is the beginning of us taking back our democracy and revolutionizing America for the better." On social media, Hogg often declares, "The young people will win." Carolyn Davis says that kind of hope is a sign of the young generation. College student Haley Fleming told VOA that the student movement is just getting started. She said, "People this age are going to start voting in the next few years. They'll be voting in the next presidential election and every election after that, and then they'll start running for Congress, and that's when this movement is really going to take shape." That kind of directed political thinking is fairly common for the post-millennial generation, notes William Fry of the Brookings Institution, a research center in Washington. He said, "They kind of look at the rest of us older people as something to push aside, not in a bombastic way, but basically just sort of shrug their shoulders and say, let's move on from all of this."
Just who belongs to the post-millennial generations is open to debate. Davis describes anyone between the ages of 15 and 24 as a post-millennial. But the Pew Research Center says anyone born from 1997 to the present is part of this generation. The oldest among them turned 21 in 2018. William Fry defines postmillennials as anyone born in 1998 to the present, people aged 20 and below. This generation has been given several names, including Gen Z, Digital Generation, iGeneration, and Hashtag Generation. Yet nothing has stuck in the same way the term millennials has for the generation before them. From what we can see, they're very liberal, they're very democratic in terms of their political expectations, said Fry. He added that compared to their own parents, or millennials, post-millennials appear to be more liberal. The tricky thing about post-millennials is they're not fully formed. When it comes to politics, young people are deeply divided along racial lines, the PRRI study found. About one-third of young white people say they are supporters of President Donald Trump. But support for Trump among blacks, 5%, and Hispanics, 17%, in the same age group is much lower. A recent PRRI survey attempted to identify the most critical issues facing post-millennials. It named the top three issues as jobs and unemployment, terrorism, and the cost of higher education. Over the years, the United States has become an increasingly more diverse country. Efforts to increase diversity are generally welcomed across all post-millennial demographic groups, but less so among young white men. Carolyn Davis said, "While this is the most diverse generation, there is no guarantee that they're going to politically be of one mind." I'm Ana Mateo.
This is What's Trending Today. Officials with the Miss America organization say the pageant is ending its swimwear part of the competition. The head of the organization, Gretchen Carlson, announced the change Tuesday. She said the event will no longer judge competitors on their appearance, but on what makes you, you. The pageant began in the seaside town of Atlantic City, New Jersey, almost 100 years ago. In recent years, women's groups and others have criticized the pageant. They say making the competitors wear swimsuits is outdated and sexist. Tuesday's announcement came after leadership changes within the Miss America organization. The changes followed reports last December that Miss America officials had criticized winners' intelligence, appearance, and sex lives. The comments appeared in emails that were made public. Women now hold the top three positions at the organization. Carlson said the organization heard from former Miss America competitors who told leaders they do not want to be out there in swimsuits. "Guess what? You don't have to anymore," Carlson said Tuesday on the television program Good Morning America. In place of the swimsuit competition, competitors will take part in a meeting with the judges. Each woman will discuss her life goals and how she will use her own skills to perform the job of Miss America, the organization said in a statement. Carlson said, "It's what comes out of their mouths that we care about." Lianza Cornette won Miss America in 1993. She supported the dropping of the swimsuit competition. She said, "In the climate of hashtag MeToo, I think it's a really wise decision. We're living in a different era now, and when we move forward for the empowerment of women, we will be taken much more seriously. And I think that's huge." The changes will start with this year's national competition in September. And that's what's trending today.
Some American students recently completed the school year, and others are preparing to end soon. But as students in some parts of the country already deal with hot classrooms, the summer break cannot come soon enough. Some new research has found that student performance drops when temperatures rise. The study mainly blames a lack of air conditioning in many U.S. schools for causing learning problems. The private nonprofit organization National Bureau of Economic Research released the working paper, Heat and Learning. Its writers are from Harvard, the University of California at Los Angeles, the University of Georgia, and the College Board. The researchers examined test results of 10 million U.S. students attending high school from 2001 to 2014. The paper says the students scored lower during hot school years than cool ones. The research is thought to be the first major study to center on the direct effects of heat on school learning. The study reported that on average, a 1 degree increase in temperature during the year before an exam led to a 1% drop in learning. The research found that days reaching at least 38 degrees Celsius reduced student scores by up to 50%. The findings suggest higher temperatures greatly harm classroom productivity for both teachers and students. Our findings suggest that even in highly industrialized economies, heat exposure can reduce the rate of learning and skill formation, the researchers reported. They wrote that students from poor families and minority groups suffered the most learning problems due to heat. The study found that higher heat affected Black and Hispanic students about 3 times more than whites. It suggested the effects of heat in the classroom could be responsible for about 13% of the U.S. racial achievement difference. The study noted that many Black and Hispanic students live in hotter places than white students. It also found more white children attended schools with air conditioning. The study reported that only high temperatures on school days caused learning problems. Hotter weather during the summer and on weekends had little influence. This suggests that heat's disruption of instruction or homework time is responsible for the observed drop in test scores, they wrote. The study showed a clear connection between lower student performance and a lack of air conditioning in schools. The researchers said school air conditioning appears to correct nearly all damaging effects of high temperatures on student achievement. Moving from a school with no air-conditioned classrooms to a school with all air-conditioned classrooms reduces the impact by approximately 78%. The study said. The researchers sought information on how many schools were air-conditioned. Information provided showed almost all classrooms in the U.S. South are air-conditioned. but a majority of classrooms in many northern and northeastern states are not. A separate investigation by the education website The 74 showed most of America's largest school districts had air conditioning in classrooms. However, 11 large districts reported many of their classrooms were not air-conditioned. Some were in places where temperatures can repeatedly reach 32 degrees Celsius or higher. In a 2014 report, the U.S. Department of Education said 30% of public schools reported having air conditioning systems that were in fair or poor condition. Last week, school officials in St. Paul, Minnesota, requested that fans and extra water be brought in to help students deal with severe classroom heat. Two-thirds of schools in the St. Paul Public Schools district do not have air conditioning. District officials said they have not seen air conditioning as necessary at all schools since they are closed during the hottest summer months. One teacher took to Twitter to report the temperature in his classroom rose to 38 degrees Celsius. History teacher Mark Westfall said he felt lightheaded and experienced head pain, both signs of heat exhaustion. He said he was also worried about his students and had to send several to see the school's health care worker. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the years after World War I, new technologies changed America. Technology made it possible for millions of people to improve their lives. It also brought great changes in American society. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell more about the technological and social changes that took place in the United States in the early 1920s.
Some of the most important changes came as a result of the automobile and the radio. Automobiles began to be mass-produced. They were low enough in cost so many Americans could buy them. Gasoline was low in cost, too. Together, these developments put America on the move as never before. Automobiles made it easy for Americans to travel. Trucks made it easy for goods to be transported. Many people and businesses moved out of crowded, noisy cities. They moved to open areas outside cities, suburbs.
As automobiles helped Americans spread out, the radio helped bring them closer together. Large networks could broadcast the same radio program to many stations at the same time. Soon, Americans everywhere were listening to the same programs. They laughed at the same jokes, sang the same songs, heard the same news. Another invention that produced big changes in American life was the motion picture.
American inventor Thomas Edison began making short motion pictures at the turn of the century. In 1903, a movie called The Great Train Robbery was the first to tell a complete story. In 1915, D.W. Griffith made a long, serious movie called Birth of a Nation. By the early 1920s, many American towns had a movie theater. Most Americans went to see the movies at least once a week. The movie industry became a big business. People might not know the names of government officials, but they knew the names of every leading actor and actress.
Movies were fun. They provided a change from the day-to-day troubles of life. They also were an important social force. Young Americans tried to copy what they saw in the movies, and they dreamed about faraway places and a different kind of life. A young farm boy could imagine himself as romantic hero Douglas Fairbanks or comedian Charlie Chaplin. A young city girl could imagine herself as the beautiful and brave Mary Pickford. Rich families and poor families saw the same movies. Their children shared the same wish to be like the movie stars. In this way, the son of a banker and the son of a factory worker had much in common. The same was true for people from different parts of the country.
In the early 1920s, Americans also began reading the same publications. The publishing industry used some of the same kinds of mass production methods as the automobile industry. It began producing magazines in larger amounts. It began selling the same magazines all over the country. One of the most widely read magazines was the Saturday Evening Post. In 1902, it sold about 300,000 copies each week. 20 years later, it sold more than 2 million copies each week. Americans everywhere shared the same information and advice in such nationwide magazines. The information was not always correct. The advice was not always good. But the effect was similar to that caused by the automobile and radio. Parts of American society were becoming more alike. They were trying to move toward the same kind of life, economically and socially.
Other industries use the techniques of assembly line production to make their goods, too. They discovered that producing large numbers of goods reduced the cost of each one. One company that expanded in this way was the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. It was called A&P for short. The A&P was one of the first large American grocery stores to sell all kinds of food. It sold milk, meat, bread, canned fruits, and vegetables, all in the same store. Shopping at the A&P was much faster and easier than going to different stores to get different kinds of food. In 1912, A&P had 400 stores in the United States. About 10 years later, it had more than 11,000 stores. It could buy huge amounts of goods and sell each at a very low price.
Mass production also came to the clothing industry. People began wearing clothes made in factories instead of by a family member or local tailor. Before long, the same kinds of clothes could be found everywhere. Mass production removed some differences that had marked Americans in the past. Prices dropped, so people with little money could still buy nice clothes. It became more difficult to look at Americans and know by their clothes if they were rich or poor.
Social changes also resulted from great progress in medical research. Doctors and scientists reported new developments in the fight against disease. This progress gave most Americans a longer life. In 1900, for example, the average person in the United States could expect to live 49 years. By 1927, the average person could expect to live 59 years.
Life expectancy rates climbed because doctors and scientists developed effective ways to prevent or treat diseases such as tuberculosis, typhoid, diphtheria, and influenza. Yellow fever and smallpox were no longer a threat. One new medicine was insulin. It was used to treat diabetes. A man-made version gave diabetics the insulin their bodies did not have. It cut the death rate from the disease from 70% to about 1%. Doctors and scientists also learned the importance of vitamins to good health. Now they could cure several diseases caused by a lack of vitamins.
Americans in the 1920s lived much better than their fathers and mothers. A man received more pay than in the past, even though he worked fewer hours each day. He lived in a better house with new labor-saving devices. He had a car to drive to work and to take his family on holiday trips. He received a better education than his father. He and his family wore better clothes. They ate healthier foods. The average American in the 1920s had more time for sports and entertainment. He enjoyed listening to the radio and watching movies. He was more informed about national and world events.
Life was good for many Americans as World War I ended and the nation entered the 1920s, yet that life was far from perfect. Many Americans did not have the same chances to improve their lives. Black Americans continued to suffer from racism. Society continued to deny them their rights as citizens. Women did not have equal rights either. For example, they could not vote. It was during this time that the United States experienced one of its worst incidents of public hatred. Many people turned strongly against labor unions and leftists. They feared a threat to democracy. The federal government took action against what it called political extremists. Many of the charges were unfair. Many innocent lives were harmed.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.